Hi, friends. Hey. I felt his energy, but the rest of you guys, that was not. Hey. So it's, what is today? It's Monday? Oh, man. It's Monday. It's 9 in the morning. I have trouble believing that you're all developers because no real developer gets up at 9 in the morning. You must be managers. Are you a manager? No? Okay. What's that? Am I a manager? No, my manager's here, actually. Oh, God, he's waving now. So now my manager, not only is he here, wave your hand, Manager Scott. That's Scott Hunter over there. He's my boss. He is actually one of three Scotts between me and Scott Guthrie. And his name isn't even Scott. It's Carl. His middle name is Scott. He changed his name to get promoted. I'm convinced of it. He saw the writing on the wall, and he said, the only way I'm going to move up at Microsoft is to change my name to Scott. It's just tragic. All right, thank you for coming. Sometimes I give a talk, and not so many people will come. But I'm glad that everyone is here, and then we've got two great days of content. Big thanks to the organizers for putting this together. Isn't this a fantastic venue? I just love this space, and I think it's really exciting that you all are here. My name is Scott Hanselman. You can go out and Google with Bing for Scott and learn about me. I've got a podcast. Anyone listen to my podcast? It's called Hansel Minutes. Good. So the people who did not raise your hands, you are bad people. It's a pretty good show. I like it. I've been doing it for 500 episodes. Wow. Did the lights go out or did I just have a stroke? I'm going to assume that was on purpose. I encourage you to check my show out. It's 30 minutes long. I've also got another show. Anyone listen to This Developer's Life? I do it with Rob Connery. Yep, two people there. That means there's 698 other people who could watch my show, listen to my show. I also do a lot of other stuff. Like I did a thing called March is for Makers. You can go to marchisformakers.com and learn about IoT. And I've got all sorts of free content on how to do Raspberry Pi and things like that. I would encourage you to check it out. And I like to do all these things. They make me very, very happy. I like to just give back to the community, and that's why I love coming to community conferences. Now, it is true that I work here. But a lot of people don't realize I don't live in Seattle. I live in Portland, which is 4 hours south. So it's actually on the forest moon where the Ewoks are. So I live outside the Redmond reality distortion field, where everyone has a Windows phone, right? I live in where people have PlayStations and iPhones and stuff like that. But the gravity of the Death Star kind of pulls me in. But I work in open source, so it's a nicer, kinder Death Star than before. Now, when I went to work for Microsoft, people said I was a sellout, because I was working in open source and I went to work there. But somehow I was able to find a way to dry my tears, as people were so very, very cruel. Here's a picture of me before I went to work at Microsoft, and here is me after. So it's Microsoft's been very good to me, so I'm happy about that. So what I want to do is, by the way, here's our org chart. Here's a funny story about this org chart. There was actually an email that was sent out around Microsoft that said, don't show them this org chart anymore. So here I am, showing you the org chart. So I was trying to figure out how I could tell them that I didn't get the email to not show you that. So I just decided that I'll tell them that Outlook was not responding. I think that's a believable story, don't you think? Maybe they'll believe me? Yeah. You know, Halloween's coming up. I'm going to be going as Microsoft Outlook. I'm going to take a shower curtain. I'm going to hang it in front of me so you can kind of see me, but not really, and it's going to say not responding. And then I'm just going to walk around and refuse to speak to anyone. What is he? He's Outlook. Not responding. So what I want to talk to you about in this talk is about JavaScript and the cloud and kind of the rise of what I call the new virtual machine. I was having a conversation with a gentleman at Intel. This is a true story, so everything I'm telling you is true, except for all of the parts that I'm lying about. I was talking to this man at Intel. He was an older gentleman. I think he was probably 75 or 80, possibly 160. And he had been at Intel for a very, very long time. He was what we would call a neckbeard. You know about this term, neckbeard? This is when you've been working on Linux so long that your beard just kind of covers your entire front. And this isn't men and women, it's the same, right? It's just, if you've been doing software for 50 years, this happens to everybody. And I was giving a presentation on how to use the internet and how to be a web developer. So this gentleman comes up, and he's been programming longer than I've been alive, okay? And he says, I'd like to learn how to program for the web. And I was like, that's amazing. Like, you're a genius programmer, been working for Intel for so long, you know all the little internals, but he doesn't know how to use the internet because he's been a low-level developer. He's been a C and assembly and microcode person. And here he is, and he's saying in 2015, the internet might be a thing. It might be useful. So I'm thinking maybe this is a good opportunity, because how would you teach someone in 2015 how to program for the web? Now, I assume everyone here has been programming for a little bit of time, maybe 5 years, maybe 10 years, maybe 20 or 25. I've been programming for 25 years for money. What if you could teach someone the web and skip all the yucky parts, the bad parts over the last 20 years, like tables and one pixel transparent GIFs, you know, and all that stuff? How would you teach them? If you could teach them about the cloud and virtual machines and scale, this was an opportunity. Now, this was a very old man. Here is a picture of him taking a selfie, just to give you a sense of the kind of a person that we're talking about here. So I said, I'm going to talk to you about two things. I want to talk to you about the cloud and what that means. What is the word the cloud? And then I want to talk about the browser. So we're going to juxtapose server and client. Now, when we say the cloud, this is a problem. This word, the cloud, is kind of a weird word because it's kind of like what young people, they just call it hosting, right? It's they say, oh, I'm going to the cloud. Well, are you really in the cloud, or did you just move that virtual machine to a host, right? The cloud is more than just hosting. It's a promise of being elastic and a promise of scale. And we're going to talk about that and explain the differences. Now, during this talk, I'm going to be bringing in a number of quotes. And I've done my best to figure out who the people are and prove that this is really a good quote. So this gentleman here, Thomas Watson, I believe he worked for IBM at some point. They say that he said, I think there's a market in the world for maybe 5 computers. But I can't prove that this exists. I don't know that this is true. And I could not find a picture of this person. But I do have this really old book. So I looked for this book. So I'm just going to say that was the guy. Just making stuff up. So you'll be seeing quotes later with random people's faces. I don't know. I'm just picking them from books that I have. When he said that there's a market for 5 computers, what kind of computer was he talking about? Was he talking about the quad processor pocket supercomputer on my wrist? No, he was talking about like refrigerators, right? Big, giant, like there would be 5 computers in the world because Europe would have one, right? And South America would have one. And there would be maybe 5 of these big, giant, filling the room computers. You would send your information to that computer as a batch, and it would come back. And this was a prediction that he made. I think this prediction actually came true, okay? Except there's the Azure computer, and the Google computer, and the bookstore, and the others. And you think of Azure as being one computer, right? And there's a market. There's about 5 of these things. And they're these big systems that are opaque black boxes that you send compute off to, and you don't think about whether it's a refrigerator or not. Now, this is a picture of Microsoft Azure. I realize that we're a little bit behind the bookstore, but we do have color now, which is really nice. And here's a picture of us unloading one of the new upgrades to Azure. So we're coming for you, and Azure is going to be pretty awesome when we get there. And he's really, there we go. He's really excited about those upgrades. So I want to talk about the cloud. I said to this gentleman, when we think about hardware and operating systems, in computer science class, they showed us a diagram that looked like this, and it contains all of the characteristics of an operating system, right? For something to have an operating system, it has to have memory management and storage and APIs and threading, right? That is what an operating system consists of, and it abstracts away the hardware. So the operating system has these characteristics, it has that hardware. And then where the magic happens is when virtual machines come into play, where you can pick that thing up and you can send it into a data center and then move it into the cloud or to someone else's data center. It's the portability of that virtual machine that is interesting, right? The idea that the virtual machine doesn't know it's virtual, right? The machine doesn't know it's in the matrix. You're lying to it. You can actually, it's amazing, you can take a virtual machine and put it on a USB key and put it in your pocket and sneak it across the border, you know? Isn't that funny? James Bond never seems to do that. There's always some complicated thing. He could just take like a mini SD card and put it under his tongue and go through customs and nothing to declare.
Nothing to declare.
But he never seems to do that. Movies would be much shorter. It would be like a 5-minute movie. Could you go into Poland and get that virtual machine?
Okay.
The little bit of spit there. And then that would be the end of the movie. I don't know why they make it so complicated. The machines don't know that they are virtual, and that's amazing and powerful. So I explained this to the gentleman, and he's like, you can do that with virtual machines. You can even run Linux on Azure. That's amazing, right? People are always impressed you can run Linux on Azure, by the way. Someone actually asked me why that was allowed. They actually said that, why would you allow that? Linux on Azure. And I said, what do you think it's running on? It's running on Windows. We win. Whee! Right? Microsoft, this is a dirty little secret about Microsoft. What does Microsoft want to sell you? Windows, Office, Xbox. But if you don't buy Windows, we'll sell you some compute. Because Microsoft doesn't want to sell you Windows. They want your for loop. Right? If you have a for loop, it's in Node, maybe your for loop's in Node.js or PHP or something. I can make that for loop happen for you. We'll put it up in Azure. That's the promise of the cloud. So these virtual machines that are now portable can be gotten from anywhere, right? They can be gotten from a USB key, or you can go somewhere like this. Like this is called VM Depot. A lot of people don't know about this. Go and search for VM Depot. And I can go and search for thousands and thousands of Linux virtual machines that I can run in Azure. So if I wanted to find one like this Jenkins virtual machine on Ubuntu, let me zoom in on that. There we go. I can go and grab this machine, this Ubuntu version of a virtual machine, and it's actually going to give me the commands that I can type to get that virtual machine and put it up into Azure. It's very, very simple. This is using the Azure cross-platform CLI. So I asked the gentleman at Intel, how do you get a virtual machine now? And he says, well, I have to fill out a form, and then I fax it to my manager. And then it goes into the cloud. And I was like, do you realize that you just said fax and the cloud in the same sentence? Like you, that's like 1985 and 2015. All in one amazing sentence. That's how you get your virtual machine in the cloud. What you want to do is you want to type Azure VM something, right? You want to come out to the command line here. And I want to type something like Azure. And when I type Azure now, you see I get ASCII art, which means that we're not evil anymore. That's what that means in case. Because that's Microsoft's way of saying, we're fun. ASCII art. Whee! So I'm going to say Azure VM list, and we're going to talk to Azure. We're going to actually make a command to go and make a JSON call out to Azure here. Look, and here's all my virtual machines. There's one I've got in Europe. And I can even go and say dash dash JSON. And this command line is actually written in Node.js, and it's entirely open source. And look at that. That's showing me all. There's my European one there. See? I can see my virtual machines, I can see the operating system, all these details. You know, I can go and grab any one of these thousands and thousands of virtual machines. People think that Azure is the .NET cloud, but it's the cloud for everybody, right? In this case, people don't realize that 20% of Azure is actually Linux. People don't know that. So I told that to this gentleman because what he wanted to hear about was choice. He wanted to know that he had choice. And I said, you pick whatever one that makes you happy. You want to say VM create? You can go and do that. Now, that's an immature cloud, though. If the first thing you do with the cloud to learn is to take a virtual machine and put it into the cloud, that's a useful thing. But it doesn't really take advantage of the cloud. Things start getting interesting when you scale that virtual machine, whether you scale it up and get more memory and more processor, or whether you scale it out and have it like a web farm. And we start to then explain the concept of IaaS, infrastructure as a service, IaaS, IaaS. That's virtual machines. And then there's platform as a service, or PaaS, P-A-A-S. That's things like websites that we'll talk about. Now, with virtual machines, I'm not a fan of virtual machines because it's, like I said, it's an immature cloud. You took a machine that's running under someone's desk and you moved it into the cloud. That was what we call lift and shift. It's the basics. It's the beginning of the cloud. But it's a virtual machine, which means you own it, right? You have to deal with it. You're responsible for it. Virtual machines are like a puppy, right? You have to feed it and water it. Or I don't have any animals. I assume you water the dog at some point. You have to keep the thing alive. You have to run Windows Update. You have to run apt-get upgrade and things like that. Remember when that SSL bug came out called Heartbleed, and everyone had to wake up in the middle of the night and patch their Linux servers? That's because with a virtual machine, you manage the operating system, you manage the apps. You have to deal with this thing. You have to own it. But the benefits are you can do anything you want. You can run anything you want. You have full control of that operating system. Websites are what I like, where you've got a limited section of things. You can do .NET, you can do Node, you can do Python, you can do PHP. Well, you're never going to do PHP, I mean, really. But, you know, you can do the good languages. And then, I'm just kidding. I love PHP people. But Azure manages the updates. Because who wants to deal with, you know, do Windows Update, right? You know? You ever notice how Windows Update always happens at the exact wrong time, right? It's almost like it knows that this would be the perfect time. Because sometimes I'll be typing, and then my hand is going to come and press Enter, right? And the gravity starts to pull my hand, and then just as my hand is going down to press Enter, Windows Update starts to come up. But it's everything is in slow motion, right? So you're like, and you can feel it. It's coming out of the, and then it's coming from like transparent Windows Update. And then it's like restart now is like default button, right? So you know I can't stop my hand because gravity is going to, and then I'm screwed. And then the window, because it happens really fast. I'm restarting. And how much time do you have when you're about to restart, right? You have that much time. And there's only one thing on the planet that is strong enough to stop Windows from restarting. You know what that is? It's a dirty notepad. So you see how fast I did that? That's because I've learned this skill as a systems administrator over the years. This computer's rebooting. I can stop it. Notepad. And then this thing pops up, yes, no, and Windows goes, I can't restart right now. There's a notepad. It's dirty. I'll give you a tip. You can actually rename Notepad to N. And this will save all of those notepads that you have to ordinarily type. You just hit N, boom, and then you'll be okay. Little tip there. You can take that back to your boss, and you can say, I am so glad that I went to .NET Developer Day because I learned a way that will prevent our servers from rebooting. It's going to be great. So you can scale up, you can get more virtual machine, but things that are really interesting is the ability to scale out, right? And I was explaining this to the gentleman at Intel because he's still thinking about things in terms of hardware, right? For him, if someone says, scale this web farm, that means he's going to go to the computer store and buy another computer and buy a router and buy a load balancer. And that's hardware problems. But here's the thing. Scaling up is a business problem, right? Your boss says, make it scale, and then you got to figure it out, right? So what do you have to do? You have to go and buy the computers and do all of that kind of work. And then your boss comes back and says, have you scaled it yet? And he sees you, you know, putting memory into a computer. He's like, what are you doing? This is not what you need to be doing. There's a word for this. We call it yak shaving. Have you heard this term? This is a real thing. It's called yak shaving. You know what a yak is, right? It's like a big, hairy, look like a bison or a buffalo. So yak shaving is a term that we use when it's all of the stuff that you need to do before the stuff that you need to do, right? So if I said, hey, can you go and deploy that Node application to the server? Well, you got to go and install Windows and install Node and then set up thing, put a Windows update, get the drivers right. You got to shave the yak before you actually do the real work. And that is why I don't like virtual machines, and that's why I don't like to do that kind of work. I want to just think about the business problem. Deploy the Node application. Scale out the system. So in the old days, in the 90s, I actually had an entire page of my CV. My resume was multiple pages. One whole page was just about how I can scale stuff, right? Install an F5, local director, Cisco, networking, A+, certifications, blah, 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 blah. And now it's a slider bar. That makes me feel really sad. I literally had to take page 2 of my resume and rip it out. I've lost the 90s. All of the 90s are gone to me because scaling is now easy. And that's annoying. I think it's frustrating when the young people say, oh, this virtual machine is taking like 5 minutes to scale. And then suddenly I turn to this old man. I'm like, when I was a boy, when we were scaling computers back in the day. And then I just shake my fist at the cloud. I was explaining this to the gentleman from Intel, and he understood that, but he was also happy that that slider bar means something. And what it means is it takes best practices for the business, best technical practices, and it is encapsulated in that slider bar. When you go and slide that bar, it takes care of the load balancing. It takes care of the networking. It takes care of the routing. All the stuff we used to have to worry about, like round robin DNS and all that stuff goes away because we did it. Like the 90s, it was important that we did that we learned that. But now, it's a commodity. It's just a thing that we do. So while I'm sad because I'm old, I'm also happy because it frees me up for doing other things. It is frustrating, though, because when I say something like Azure Site Scale, and then it says updating a server farm, that's one sentence. That's the 90s for me. The entire decade is right there and now updating a server farm. Doesn't it just make you sad a little bit? No, maybe it's because you're young people. I look at that and I realize all that time that I lost. But then when I was explaining this to this gentleman from Intel, I was excited for him because think of all the time he's going to save. He just doesn't have to know about those things. That elasticity, that ability to scale the cloud is handled for him completely. That is all in one slider bar. So I can go into something like an Azure website, right? And I can see all the details and it looks like magic. What just happened? Some people have no idea what happens. They just know that it scaled out, and it just worked, didn't it? So then the gentleman asked me, well, what language do I use to talk to the cloud? Do I have to use .NET? Do I have to use Node? Do I have to use PHP? And I said, well, a good cloud doesn't care about language choice, right? Any language that makes you happy. I've actually told people in the past, and I still believe this, that if you want to be successful as a developer, you should learn two languages, JavaScript and a systems language, something on the back end. So that might mean JavaScript and F#, JavaScript and C#, JavaScript and Erlang. It doesn't matter. It's just JavaScript and something. You want to be able to do something where you can write large scalable systems in the cloud, okay? And he thought that was amazing, and he got a little bit lightheaded. So The other thing I said is that open source is important, being able to do this stuff in any way that you can. So if you pick your cloud, whether it be Azure or another cloud, make sure that everything is open source. All of the Azure SDKs are open source. The Azure command line is open source. The Azure documentation is open source. ASP.NET 5 is open source and runs on Linux. This guy thought that was great because as a developer, he wants to read the code, right? He doesn't want to just read the documentation. He wants to read the code and contribute to the code. This is actually a list of all of the open source that exists in Visual Studio. A lot of people don't realize how much is going on there, but that's all stuff that we ship inside Visual Studio that is open source. It's lots and lots of stuff. Now, we were talking about the distance between the business person and the technical problem. And the business person might say scale, and then the business person says scale, and the technical person has to figure out the techie stuff to move around. But a really good cloud can hide that stuff. Okay. Now, I was at a conference once in Norway. I think it was Norway. Could have been Sweden, Finland. I don't know. It was cold. And one of the people there who was speaking was the chief architect at the time of Netflix. And he was talking about IOPS, right? Input-output operations per second. It's this number that the cloud uses to describe throughput. Usually you get a number like 300 IOPS or 500 IOPS, and that's how fast you can talk to the disk. So when you're buying virtual machines, you'll say, I'm going to pay $1 a month or $1 or whatever per unit for 500 IOPS. Now, he found out that the cloud he was using, it was Amazon, had old hard drives, like spinning rust hard drives. That's how they work. And it was going to be $1 for 500 IOPS. Or he could upgrade to SSDs, right? And this would be a push button. He just have to go and configure the virtual machines. He didn't have to do anything. He just upgrade to SSDs. And then it would be $3 for like 6,000 IOPS. So think about that from a business person's perspective. Remember that this isn't the chief technical person. This is the chief architect. So he's right on the edge of business person, right? He's got a suit. And he says, well, you know, it's $1 for 500, or it's this much for 6,000 or 3,000. $3, you know, three times more money, 10 times more perf. Let's do it. Let's go to SSDs. This is a great idea. And he explained the whole decision process. And they push a button, and perf goes up, and everyone's happy. At the end of the talk, a young person, and I'm sorry to pick on the young people. If there's anyone here under 20, I apologize. But this person was probably 19 or 18. And he comes up, and I can't do a Norwegian accent, but I can do nerd. So he's like, well, actually, sir, you know, the SSDs are extremely unreliable, and they're going to have high failure rate. The SSDs will be, you know. Basically, he's told the chief architect of Netflix, you're an idiot. You shouldn't be using SSDs because they're unreliable. Why did you do that, and why did you just waste our time? And we were like, you know, like, your jaw dropped out. And this guy was, like, English, and he had a little suit on, and he gets, like, you know, +2 charisma just for being English. And he's got a PhD in something, PhD in, I don't know, Netflix. And why would you do that? Why would you say that? So we're just like, oh, like, what are we gonna do with this kid? So he sat there quietly, and he said, the kid's like, what do you think about that, sir? And the guy says, that's not my problem. I'm renting them. Think about that. That's not my problem. SSDs have a high failure rate. You know, they're really, really high perf, but they fail a lot. Are you worried about that? And he's like, no. And I don't know how they do it in Poland, but do you ever have, like, where they drop the mic? You know, like you're singing or you're rapping, and you're just like, I'm out. Now, he didn't have a mic. He had one of these, so he couldn't exactly, like, take this off and then, you know, drop a tiny microphone and be like, Netflix. You know, because he was English and he was an older guy. You know, it wouldn't really work like that. But that's kind of what we saw in our mind, right? Now, he blew this kid's brains out, and the kid didn't even know it, right? Because what's his layer of abstraction that he's working at is the larger business strategy. Whose fault is it if the SSDs fail? It's the cloud's fault. Maybe 20% of them fail. Amazon would need to fix that. That would be a problem, right? But you have fault tolerance in the cloud. That's different than how you get at a host. I've had times where my host is down, and that just means that the machine that ran my blog was down, and I had to wait. The client might think it's my fault, but I'm responsible for my availability. But if SSDs go down, I've got triple redundancy. So if 20% of the SSDs fail, Netflix still stays up. Okay? So this kid didn't think about any of that stuff. He thought he was being smart. So he got destroyed. But the part that was amazing was that the kid still stood there, like in a ninja movie when they cut the head, like chomp, and then the head is still sitting there, and then it starts to slide down the body, and the body's like, I didn't have a picture of this, but I did find this GIF. It was kind of like this. The guy got destroyed because he wasn't thinking about the level of abstraction, right? When you're thinking about things at the cloud level, you're going to think about it like this, like a global map, a dashboard that describes everything. They literally set up the European deployment of Netflix, pressed a button, and then rolled it out. You know, and then I guess they went to, you know, play golf or something. That's amazing. Too often, people forget that the cloud is about an additional layer of abstraction, or two or three. You don't think about the metal when you're thinking about things in the cloud. People try to fill their lives with dashboards, and they say, well, I don't need the cloud. I've got my dashboard. I actually had someone tell me that this was a good enough dashboard for them. They were like, yeah, I got top. That's my dashboard. DevOps, baby. And then another guy was like, I got HTOP. It's in color. That's wrong. You have to up-level. You have to think about things in a different perspective. People get their heads around something being right, something being correct, something being better, and it's just wrong. It's like when people think that Mario is better than Luigi. Everyone knows Luigi is the hero of the story. See, someone just clapped. The one guy, like, he does. Don't be afraid to represent Luigi. He's like, yes, yes. Testify, right? You can't tell me, Luigi, yes. It's all about, you can't, the cloud is simply better than things like a top. Here's another story about why this is true. There was a team of interns at the New York Times, and they were given terabytes of TIFF files, big, messy, fat TIFF scans of the New York Times. And they were tasked with OCRing, using OCR, optical character recognition, on all of those TIFF files and making readable PDFs. So think about that problem. This is a typical kind of a problem. It's a one-time problem where you're given a whole bunch of data and you have to write a for loop. Remember that for loop where Microsoft wants your money? That for loop, for each TIFF file, run OCR, combine them into a PDF. They were given this task, and they were a bunch of interns. How would they do this? Well, for loops are a very naive thing, because you say, yeah, for each, yeah, no problem, right? And then someone says, okay, how many files are there? 1 million. Okay, well, how long will it take for that for loop to go? Oh, until the sun death of the universe. So then you have to start thinking about scaling and threading and multi-threading and stuff like that. And this can become a big problem because if you're thinking about it in terms of the metal, like the man from Intel was thinking about things, if you're thinking about it in terms of finite resources, you're going to be like, oh man, we got to go get a bigger computer. But also, the boss said, OCR these files. That was the business requirement. OCR these files. And now you're going to go and shave a yak. Well, I need to have a 64-bit, 64 gigs of memory, and I have to have 64-bit computer, and I have multi-threading, and I have to write C code that does across multiple processes and multiple, you know. Suddenly, I'm yak shaving. I'm thinking about computer science stuff. But multi-threading isn't hard. It's just tedious and extremely error-prone. Dealing with things that of this scale are not really part of the business problem. So this is where the cloud comes in. You could go and just say, I want a giant computer, or I want 100 of these, or I need a batch of 1,000. The folks at the New York Times actually spent $300 over a weekend, got a whole bunch of computers, ran them all in parallel, and then did the work, and then turned them all off, and it cost $300. In fact, it only cost them $150, but they had to run it twice because the first run had an error. But the thing that they had to spend most of their time doing was writing multi-threaded, multi-processor, multi-system aware code. So there are some people who are thinking about batch problems. I'll zoom in on this a little bit. Problems to solve larger issues in a batch. Like here's a do-it function where we're just going to read in some text and then append I ran in the cloud. Okay, but you'll notice that there's no for loop here, is there? That's just the one thing, OCR this file. With something like this, this is some thought we're putting into batch development. What if you could go and put in front of that, blobs come in here and they go out there. And then the for loop happens in the cloud, right? You're describing something that's more functional. And then that big scale problem turns into a money problem, right? How do you want to move the slider bar? And the cloud will handle that stuff for you. Because naive for loop issues like that are known quantities. They are solved problems from a computer science perspective. So I told the gentleman from Intel that he's got unlimited computing power. He can pick any language that he wants. He can pick a cloud that's open source. He'll be able to do the coding in the way that makes him happy. He was a C++ person. But he also has to up-level his thinking and not just think about virtual machines. He has to think about batch jobs that are not thinking about virtual machines, or think about websites as he gets farther and farther away from the metal. So he starts thinking about building a scalable website, but then I say, wait, we haven't talked about the browser yet. We're going to switch from the server side to the client side. Remember this diagram. These are the characteristics of an operating system. Now, there was a time when you would sit down in front of a computer that looked like that, and you would start typing, and the work would actually happen on a computer that looked like this. Okay? And the UI would come up, and there we go. The UI would come up, and where did that UI come from? Right? That came from the refrigerator, but it appeared on this screen. Is that computer doing any work? It's not really. It's just kind of hanging around, waiting for the UI to come over to it. We're treating our machines these days like this. You know, I have a quad processor machine with 8 gigs of RAM, and it spends most of its time waiting for HTML. So someone might have 10 machines in their web farm, and I've got 1,000 people trying to talk to those 10 machines. Those 1,000 machines have 3D accelerated graphics, have quad processors, and they're waiting for 10 machines to get in line, much like registering for .NET Developer Days. Yeah, see what I did there? Sorry, it was too easy, I had to go for it. No, my point is, though, we need to think about how to use those local resources, right? He was saying that you'll be able to register for yourself, right? That's a great scalability point that he said. You'll register yourself. We'll talk about what that means, because we can use the brain power of the client, the brain power of the browser. Now, this here is actually the first web page. This is the home of the web. This actually still exists. It's CERN. This is Tim Berners-Lee's first homepage. You can go there to the same URL today from the very beginning. And it's right there. This is Tim Berners-Lee, the creator of the internet. By the way, do you ever have the people at work that have really fancy job titles? I just want to point out that he just said web developer. He didn't say the web developer. Like if you had a business card that said, oh, what do you do? Oh, I made the web. Just say, the web developer. So yes, people should state their titles more accurately. And actually, funny story about Tim Berners-Lee. There's a guy at work when I visit Seattle. I was talking to this gentleman in the kitchen. His name is Heinrich, and he was a very nice guy. And I start chatting with Heinrich, and then he leaves. And then my buddy Phil Hack, who used to work at Microsoft, he's at GitHub now. Phil comes up and he goes, "Do you know who that is?" Nothing good ever happens when someone says that to you. "Do you know who that is?" Because I don't know who that guy is. And I go, "That's Heinrich, right?" And he goes, "He made HTTP." And I was like, "Oh, you mean for ASP.NET?" And he's like, "No, for everyone." So I went and I looked at the HTTP specification. And there it is, first line, Heinrich Nielsen. He was Berners-Lee's intern. And he works on our team. He's the guy that architected parts of a web API, and he's working on webhooks now. So Phil ruined Heinrich for me, because now the next time I see him, I can't look him in the eye. Because what do you say? What have I done? I've done nothing. So I was like, "Hey, Heinrich, good job on the internet." Definitely Visual Basic, definitely. I can't even look Heinrich in the eye anymore because he made HTTP. So then Berners-Lee makes the internet, and then this happens. How do we know that this happened? It's because we were surfing the web and we were going from page to page, and then Java loaded. That's how we knew. Oh, you'll clap for that. I've been working hard for you guys for 45 minutes, and that's where I get a clap? Maybe I'll get another one here. So this happens, and then these guys come along. And they're like, "We can do it too." And then these guys are like, "But we've got YouTube. We're still relevant." But what are we doing with these things? Okay, what are we doing with these technologies? What we're doing is we were making plug-in virtual machines. We did it because we wanted more from the internet. But they were islands of virtual machines. There was the larger web around it, and then we'd have this thing running inside of a frame within a frame within a frame. I actually went to, there's another story. I'm full of stories, I'm afraid. I went to the Toyota dealership because I have a Prius, and I'm getting the car fixed. And I don't know, you all are nerds, right? You're computer people. You know how when you're somewhere either checking in at the airport or maybe at the auto body store, like the Toyota dealership, you want to see what their system is like, right? Do you ever do that? You're like, "What's going on there?" You know. And then what happens with me is I'm like, and by the time at the end, I'm like sitting next to them, and I'm like, "Oh yeah, so F3 is what you press." So I'm always trying to figure out what they're doing. And they had like an AS400 terminal thing, and they would VT100. They had a terminal emulator, and they would talk to this thing. And then one day I show up, and the computer has been upgraded. And I'm like, "Oh," and the guy knows that I'm a nerd. He's like, "Oh yeah, let me show you the new system. New system, it's great." So he goes to the new system, and he boots up Windows XP. And I was like, "Oh God," you know. I didn't want to tell him, but I was like, "Oh no, this is not going to be good." And then he boots up Firefox. And then he opens a jar file, and then it says, "Are you sure you want to run Java?" And he's like, "I'm sure." And then it says, "Type your national identification code if you want to run Java." "Are you really, really sure you want to run Java?" And then he opened a jar file of a terminal emulator, and then terminaled back into the same AS400, then looked me in the eye and said, "This is way better than before." People don't even realize what we're doing to the internet, right? The web became this island where you'd have the internet, and then you'd have an island of a virtual machine, whether it be Silverlight or Flash or whatever, right? And you just use it to show teapots and stuff. It was very sad. That's not what Berners-Lee meant this to be for. And just to pick on Java for a second, right? I mean, it was right once, looked like crap everywhere. I'm not talking about Java on the server side. That's fine. I'm talking about applets. I'm not a fan of applets. So then all the while this is happening, right? JavaScript is happening. It's just slowly coming alive within the browser. And by the way, don't ever do this. They don't like that. It's not Java. You ever had those explained? We've all explained to our boss that Java and JavaScript are different, right? It's 2015. They still don't understand, do they? Yeah. Very sad. This is a flow chart that shows you what it's like to work in JavaScript. just to get you a sense of what you're working with. What? JavaScript. So this is happening, and people are starting to do amazing stuff with it. This is a Commodore 64 emulator written entirely in JavaScript. Because we didn't really think JavaScript was good for anything, right? It was just a toy. Does anyone remember the first time that you realized JavaScript was actually useful? I think we've all had the exact same experience. You're filling out a form, and you hit tab, and the form field turned yellow. And you go, and then you fill out your phone number again, and you hit tab, and it turns yellow, and it validates the form. And you go, I don't think it posted back to the server. You know, and, oh my God, JavaScript is more than just saying alert, pwned. You can actually do stuff with it, right? So I grabbed my computer and I just ran to my wife and I said, it didn't post back to the server. And my wife was like, I don't care. So we can start building like real stuff in JavaScript. So someone went and built this. Check this out. That's not my folder. What's going on? Why am I talking to myself? What's happening? This is a complete Linux virtual machine in JavaScript. And you know how you know? You select the text. Because you'll look at it and you're like, I don't know. And you'll right-click and it'll say about Flash. And you're like, liar! Because anytime anyone does anything cool on the internet, you have to right-click on it. And you select, oh, that's really JavaScript. And then we see, well, can we do something with it? Can I maybe compile a C application inside of a JavaScript virtual machine, inside of Chrome, inside of Windows? And then actually run a Hello World application written in C inside of JavaScript? I did this once in a demo at an open source conference, and a gentleman screamed out of the audience, why aren't you using GCC? And I was like, okay. I just compiled a C application in a JavaScript virtual machine inside of Chrome, inside of Windows. Asshole. And you don't appreciate that? Okay, I'm sorry I picked the wrong C compiler. I'm going to have to prove that you're a jerk. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to fire up on my Windows machine an iPhone emulator, and then I'm going to bring up a JavaScript virtual machine inside of Safari, inside of an iPhone on the Windows machine, and then compile C within that. And I'm going to use whatever C compiler I feel like. You jerk. This is like Inception, isn't it? You see Inception? That movie was about that if you run a virtual machine inside of another virtual machine, time slows down. It's true. You guys are making me work hard for the claps. Yeah. Don't disable JavaScript, because you will die. Funny thing I learned, actually very, very true thing, is that when you meet someone for the first time, you know, like, how do you know if your friend is a vegan? They'll tell you. Vegans, CrossFit, and people who browse the web with JavaScript disabled. They will tell you before they introduce their name. Hi, how you doing? I run with JavaScript disabled. I'm also a vegan CrossFitter. I don't eat gluten. I don't have any gluten. I don't own a television. F-sharp developers, yeah. But fortunately, they're here, and we have great F-sharp people to learn from, so that's pretty exciting. So this is sometimes the part of the conversation where people say, well, I guess Scott is going to tell me now that we can run Quake in a browser, right? And then maybe he'll show us how you can take C++ and you can compile it through Clang and Inscriptum and through Asm.js and then use WebGL, and you can run an entire instance of something like Quake or something in a browser. That's usually where the next step is. People assume that. But I'm not going to do it. Not going to do it. No. Because it's too obvious. It's too obvious. I won't do it. So if you take all of the characteristics of JavaScript and all the characteristics of a virtual machine and you overlay them over each other, maybe JavaScript is an operating system. Right? It's got garbage collection, it's got graphics subsystems for both 2D and 3D, it's got a security sandbox, it's got its own database, things shipped for the database, that's more than most operating systems. You've got APIs for geolocation, web workers. That is the virtual machine that we've been waiting for, right? Adobe didn't kill Flash, Microsoft didn't kill Silverlight, Java still sucks. The web killed those things, because the water level rose and the web now has those features. JavaScript is the virtual machine that we've been waiting for this whole time. Now, Jeff Atwood from Atwood's Law indicates that any application that can be written in JavaScript will eventually be written in JavaScript. Like we just saw, an entire Linux entirely in Excel. This is a complete pixel-perfect instance of Pac-Man where each pixel is a cell. And this is so pixel perfect, this is actually written by a Japanese guy, that it can't be stopped. I'm going to have to, I think I'm in not responding right now. That's how powerful Excel is. So that's a famous quote. Now, if JavaScript is an operating system, then your phone has two operating systems, right? It's got the one in the browser and it's got the one around it, which means that you should be thinking about, should I do stuff in JavaScript or should I write native applications? Now, this guy said that HTML5 wasn't ready. He didn't think HTML5 was baked enough that he should bet on it. So they went and they took their HTML5 application that they wrote for Facebook and they wrote it all over again in native code. I disagree. I think HTML5 is happening, and you can absolutely bet on it. After he said that, a group at Sentia.js went and wrote a Facebook clone in Sentia that's actually faster than native, which indicates that they're really good programmers, but that you can do stuff in JavaScript as well as you can in native. JavaScript could be the new metal, the new assembly language. Now, here's a great quote. Speaking of quotes, the avalanche has already begun. It is too late for the pebbles to vote. Do you know who said that one? That's a great quote. The avalanche is HTML5. Do you understand? The mountain is coming down, and your boss is the pebbles. He's going, I don't really know if HTML's ready. Do you think it's going to happen? Is the internet, is it a good bet? Should we use the internet? Do you know who said that? True story. He's one of our great JavaScript developers here. I think that's the original translation there. Fine JavaScript. He uses jQuery, actually. It's true. Totally true. Now, when you say HTML5, if you're betting on HTML5, you're really talking about JavaScript and CSS and HTML5 as a collective, right? As a group. It's all of those things together. And those are some web developers. That guy's legs just go right into his back. There's no butt at all. I think it's funny that we call it HTML5, though, because there were, you know, HTML doesn't really do anything, right? HTML is just kind of a div. There was a time, though, when HTML was incredibly complicated. There was a time when HTML tables were the most complicated thing you could do with computers, where you could get a job just because you know tables. Does anyone remember those times? I literally got a job as a web designer. Do you know how to do tables? Yes. Junior engineer. A couple months later, do you know how to do Rospan? Senior engineer. I know that the maximum number of tables in Netscape 4 is 32 nested tables. And the only way you know that is when you've written 33 and you stare at the face of Satan himself. It's true. But now HTML is very simple. You just see things like a div, like that. And HTML is just the structure. All the work is happening with CSS. And CSS is this wonderfully expressive language that allows you to get exactly what you wanted the first time. no one has any trouble understanding CSS or accomplishing something with CSS because it's such a well-documented and predictable language. And then you use JavaScript for everything else. HTML is really not involved. This is me every time I use JavaScript. Because you know you have it in your mind what you're going to do, and it just it never quite works out. I love that kid. That's a great. And the great thing about JavaScript now is that you don't even need to learn the bad parts. Stepping through some JavaScript. Now, John Resig wrote jQuery, right? John Resig has a book that's called Secrets of the JavaScript Ninja. That is a samurai. So I asked him why that you put a samurai on a JavaScript Ninja book. And he said, by the way, is samurai a ninja samurai? He says, it's okay because JavaScript is loosely typed. Duck typing. Sorry for that joke. Now, here's a great quote. JavaScript is the assembly language of the web. Who said that? I did say that. Thank you. Nicely done. That's a great quote. The thing is about that quote is that everybody said it, right? I mean, it's just one of those quotes that everybody said. I just said it first. It doesn't really matter. So actually, I don't know if I said it first. I said it on the internet, and then Reddit disagreed and said that's crap. JavaScript is not the assembly language of the web. So then I called some of the people who created JavaScript and asked them. And I went and I called Brendan Eich, who invented JavaScript. And I said, do you think this is true? And actually, I think that is American actor Brendan Fraser. That is Brendan Eich. But you know, Brendan Fraser is a good-looking guy, so we'll leave him up there. He said, I think JavaScript is the x86 of the web, but I can't claim it's original. Everyone thinks this. It's the obvious thing to think, right? And now it actually happened. Since I started giving this talk, this is happening, which I take to mean you were totally right, Scott. Suck it, internet. WebAssembly is a thing. JavaScript is now happening, and you're going to evolve to the point where you can compile, and you can think of JavaScript as a on-the-metal programming language, which is amazing. And it's a joint effort between everybody, between Google and Microsoft and Mozilla and all the good people. So that's actually happening. Yay! All right. I'm going to skip a couple of things because people are telling me I need to get going. Last thing I want to say is about layers. I mentioned jQuery, and I don't mean to pick on jQuery, but a lot of people feel that jQuery is the way to go, but they let the layer that they add hide complexity. And then you think that you're slick because you learned jQuery. But then you're not. I'm going to do that one more time. This is jQuery. I'm using jQuery. Yay. I don't really know JavaScript at all. People say that no one writes JavaScript anymore, right? They write jQuery. People have actually said, hey, can you write some JavaScript in a job interview? And then they'll just go and start writing a dollar sign, and they're like, whoa, 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 you don't know what you're doing. Who said that quote, no one writes JavaScript anymore, they write jQuery? That was actually said by jQuery. This is a real guy, so I'm just going to put his face there. The great thing about learning that jQuery exists is that I've ruined jQuery for you. Like, you won't be able to go back to your job after this conference and be like, should we use jQuery? I don't know. Is he available? I'll call his agent. Yeah, you can't say jQuery without thinking about him. Here is his IMDb page and some of the work that he's been doing. It's pretty good. He was on an episode of Chicago Fire, up-and-coming young actor. So you think that you're going to build something and you have this vision about how awesome it's going to be, and then when it ends up getting built, it's not the way you wanted, and you don't know why, and you can't figure out who it is to blame. And then you're sad. And you're like, I don't even know. So I think people should do more vanilla JS. Really understand. People are nodding. Yes, use vanilla JS. Do the lower end stuff. People, I am amazed how folks will go and write a brand new JavaScript framework when they make their startup. There's a whole rich world of JavaScript frameworks out there. So when you make your first startup, how much time did you spend writing a new framework in JavaScript? I'm going to skip past this. Just imagine that these slides were amazing. Blah, blah, blah. Amazing, amazing, amazing. Animation. So, in closing, you have an unlimited number of virtual machines. This is what I told the gentleman from Intel. You can scale and you can write in any language at all that makes you happy. But don't forget that the user has a virtual machine. So if 1,000 people are hitting 10 computers, there's actually 1,010 machines going on right there. Why do we continue now to have a table of data, click on a column to sort that data, and then send it to a server for sorting? If only the Intel processor could sort data on the client side, that would be amazing, wouldn't it? It's shocking that we don't do that. You have a powerful virtual machine. You have libraries like D3JS. Put that person's computer to work. Do some processing on the client side. Have a balance between the cloud and the other virtual machine. So this is my message to you, that you are powerful and that you know this stuff. Yeah, that guy's pretty awesome. Oh, I'm back. I'm doing it again. So get to work. Thank you very much.